with Canto 12, from Canto 12 to Canto 16, we are still in what is known the middle ground, which is a moral ground, the middle ground of hell. We are between the area of incontinence that we saw in the last few weeks and the area of malice. And this middle ground, which is the ground of violence or bestiality, as it is also called. What I want to draw your attention to, first of all, is the fact that Dante's presiding symbols, the presiding figures in this area, are all figures, hybrid figures, figures of doubleness. The Minotaur and the Centaurs in Canto 12. You have the Harpies, these filthy, foul figures, monsters, with the face of women, devouring all the foliage in the tree, in the trees, Canto 13. And then this will go on with other emblems of, again, monsters and the figure of, but that's the figure of fraud. I don't want to get into that. Figures of also, again, Minotaurs and Centaurs in 15. What is the importance of these figures? They are Neoplatonic images, figures of Centaurs, Minotaurs, understood to signify the doubleness of human beings, the capacity of human beings to join within themselves both the human and the bestial or animal, experiences, possibilities of being. In Neoplatonic thinking, especially in the 12th century, since it's to give it a historical ring to what we are saying, the 12th century, the so-called Chartians, and more so in the 15th century Florence with Pico, the figures, the whole idea is that human beings are really a kind of copula or neutral entities capable of, who have the potential of this doubleness within them. They're capable of becoming fully rational or descending into bestiality. And the position in the ladder of being is one of utter indeterminacy. In the 12th century, this is not the case. They still believe in these images, fixed images of entities, creatures, capable of being at the same time expressing these dual impulses, the bestial and the human impulse. This is Dante seems to be quite aware that somehow the symbols do not completely characterize what human beings really are, the ability of human beings to redeem themselves, to free themselves out of a certain state or fall, plunge into the opposite state. So there's a difference between the symbols and what human beings are going to be able to do. This is really the reason why I focused on Canto, asked you to read Canto 12, where Dante places tyrants. It's really an anonymous canto. There are no great figures, no great personalities. We do know, and Dante gives a list of all the tyrants of his time, and the tyrants, Dionysus of Syracuse, Alexander, the Ezzelino of his own time in Padua, etc. They are the figures of tyranny, but at the same time, he places next to them figures of educators, figures of teachers, such as, for instance, Chiron. And this is a little bit ironic because it has come straight after Dante's exemplary representation of Virgil's own teaching in Canto 11. You remember when Virgil goes on explaining in great detail the shape of Inferno. Here now, once again, Dante takes the other perspective, that which he takes to be the tyranny of teaching. That is to say, a sort of teaching that does not allow that freedom that the very symbols, the very presiding figures of this canto also seem to to deny. I mean, they are forever man and beast. And Dante claims clearly that there is a teaching that has to allow the sort of the freedom to move, either in the direction of rationality or the freedom or the choice to move in its opposite direction. So this is the substance, I think, of Canto 12. We come, though, to Canto 13, which is one of the most remarkable cantos of Inferno. It's the canto of the suicides. And Dante encounters here a figure, a poet, very well-known poet, a very well-known figure of the middle part of the 13th century, called Pierre de Levigne. And as you read through the canto, you will see that he puns on both terms of the name. Peter, and he thinks of himself as a figure of Peter, one who holds the keys, the two keys of the kingdom, the keys of power, but also the last name, Pierre de Levigne, meaning of the vineyard. And this is because we are going to witness now a metamorphosis of a human being, the metamorphosis of a human being from being human to becoming a vegetable, a plant. This is the story of suicides. And we shall see what Dante thinks about suicides. Why does he think such an evil as to be condemned in this area of violence against the self? You do know how Dante, I don't have to go over this, but you do know that Dante distinguishes violence against self, violence against others, as in Canto 12, violence against nature, and violence even against the divinity in Canto 14. Let's look at Canto 13, a little bit of some textual details, and then we'll discuss some of the issues of the canto. Nessus had not yet reached the other side again when we set out through a wood which was not marked by any path. Here there seems to be no directions at all, almost as if Dante were revisiting Canto 1 of Inferno, the same idea of a sense of loss of self and adumbrating what suicide may also be at some level, a loss of some idea of one's own being, some idea of what one is or should be. We are not told anything more, but then rather Dante shifts to a description of the natural landscape, the world of nature, the landscape, and you as you read, you must be struck by how he is highlighting a peculiar style. And I want to emphasize this style, these figurations of style. No green leaves, but of dusky hue. A series of antitheses. First of all, a series of antitheses, but also anaphoras, negatives. No smooth boughs, but knotted and warped. Antithetical, but at the same time, repetition of this, no, anaphoric, no, no. No fruits were there, but moistenous thorns. No breaks so harsh and dense that the savage beasts that hate the tilled lands between the Cesena and Corneto. We are in what in a place, in a landscape, where this is the style called, there is a technical term for the rhetoric Dante deploys, it's called privatio, which simply means a privation. Emphasizing there's nothing positive here, but it's a way of subtracting from what is missing rather than what is there. There is really a negation, the style of a negation, but at the same time, through the antithesis, making us think about how the world might be. No green leaves, but of dusky hue. So this is a style of taking away from any substantial description of the landscape. No breaks so harsh and dense, etc. Here make their nests the loathsome harpies. Again, a hybrid figures, just as we had the centaur in the previous canto. From the strophades, with dismal presage of future ills. They have wide wings and human necks and faces, feet clawed and their great bellies feathered, and they make lamentations on the strange trees. So we are in a world where we're really a world of negation, a world of monstrosities, and a world of privation. What is happening to human beings here? That's really the question that he seems to be raising. But let me just proceed even more carefully here. The whole scene recasts an important scene in Book 3 of the Aeneid. This is indeed also a major confrontation between Dante. The whole canto dramatizes a major confrontation between Dante and Virgil, the author of the Aeneid, about some of these issues. What is a metamorphosis? What is nature? What is the place of human beings within nature? Because Dante and Virgil think in a sharply different ways. For the metamorphosis, for instance, the scene that Dante here is recalling is the scene of Book 3 of the Aeneid, where Polydorus, a cousin of Aeneas, has been killed. And he's, you remember, there is a speaking tree scene there too. Aeneas arrives in Thracia, which is Asia Minor. He thinks that is the place which the gods have assigned to him. And he does that which he feels, that which he knows has to be done wherever and whenever you want to build a city. Consecrate the ground. Hallow the ground by building an altar and by purifying the ground through fire. As he tries to do this, the altar is always at the center, in the Aeneid, at the center of the human community. He's plucking a bough, and he hears a voice. He shudders, he's scared, and the voice comes. It's Polydorus, his cousin, who tells the story that he's been killed because of the sacrilege that has been committed. Whatever consecration Virgil wants us to believe, to think of, cannot be really carried out because the sacrilege has been that of the killing of Polydorus on account of the gold that he carried, that they wanted to plunder him of. They want to rob him of. So Aeneas hears a voice. Why do you pull me out of this? And Polydorus simply asks that a proper burial be given to him so that he can descend peacefully into Hades. Aeneas complies and leaves that place in the knowledge that is not the place assigned to him. The sacrilege was such that he cannot really quite found the city on the place of a crime, such an atrocious crime. Dante is revisiting that particular scene. In fact, I repeat, Canto 13 recasts that scene. And it's a major encounter with Virgil and Virgil's whole pattern, whole system of values. And let's see how this is going to continue. So we have the background with some stylistics of negativity, the styles of negation, as if suicide were this fundamental sacrilege that denies some reality that we don't know yet. And the good master began to speak to me. So Virgil intervenes. Reminding us that this is indeed Book 3 of the Aeneid, which, by the way, another little detail, Book 3 of the Aeneid is the book of the Aeneid that Dante draws from the most. And if some of you want to write a paper on how many scenes Dante takes and why, you should go ahead and write that kind of paper. One reason is that Book 3 of the Aeneid is the book of Aeneas' exile. The homelessness of Aeneas. Aeneas is still nowhere. He's just has just left Troy. He's going to about to leave Carthage, Dido's home, and about to get to into Sicily, but never really quite being able to say, this is really where I belong. This is really the place one can call home, whatever that may be for him. The good master began to speak to me. Virgil interrupts. Before that, go farther, know that thou art in the second round and shall be until thou come to the horrible sand. Look well, therefore, and thou shalt see things that would discredit my telling of them. This is a hyperbole on the part of Virgil. You are going to see what I have been describing. In a sense, this is the reason why I'm an authority and why I'm guiding through this, because I have seen, imaginatively at least, I have seen some of the things that you are experiencing, and what you will see, the reality of it all, will exceed my own abilities to tell of it. A stance of humility on the part of the teacher, therefore a mild correction of the claims about teaching in Canto 12. You see, this is one theme that seems to be running through. And then Dante continues, "I heard from every side wailings poured forth, and saw none that made them, so that, all bewildered, I stopped." And now, another conceit that we shall come back to. "I think he thought I thought." It's clearly, we call it an amplification, a way of playing with one verb, but also inferring what the thought of the other would be. It's a descent into a kind, into the boundaries of one's own mind, a way in which Dante dramatizes the fact that there is no real conversation now going on between him and Virgil. It's a way of descending into the what I call exactly the loneliness of Dante's own thoughts. I think, and then reiterated once again, anaphoric. "I think he thought I thought," more of this later, "that all the voices among the trunks came from people who were hiding from us. So the master said, if thou break off any little branch from one of these trees, all thy present thoughts will prove mistaken. Then I put out my hand a little and plucked a twig from a great thorn, and its trunk cried." And this is Aeneid 3, lines 39 and following. That's the way book 3 of the Aeneid begins. "Why dost thou tear me? And when it turned dark with blood, it began again. Why manglest thou me? Hast thou no spirit of pity? We were men, and now are turned to stalks. Thy hand might well have been more pitiful had we been souls of serpents. As a green brand that is burning at one end drips from the other and hisses with escaping wind, so from the broken splinter came forth words and blood together, at which I left fall the tip and stood as one afraid." And Virgil intervenes, "If he could have believed before, wounded soul, what he had never seen but in my lines, in my Aeneid, he would not have stretched forth his hand against him." My sage replied, "But the thing being incredible made me prompt him to the deed which grieves myself. But tell me who thou wast, so that for some amends he may revive thy fame in the world above, where he's permitted to return." The irony of reviving the fame in a place where there is no possibility of revival, there is no possibility of coming back to life indeed, where the natural world is not capable of behaving naturally, where there's no real growth, no real change here. It's always going to be, it's the most unnatural of places. So the shadow of this unnaturalness is going to be cast over the scene with the encounter with Brunetto Latini. What is this idea here? In a sense, this is already the confrontation between Virgil and Dante, if he could have believed that which he had discovered. It is as Dante wants to test the truth value of what he had read in the Aeneid. He had read the scene of the Aeneid, let me see how this is, and finds out that that which he sees is entirely different from Virgil's account. In a way, he's really drawing our attention to what we call the act of reading. How do we read? What do we believe when we read a story? And we read a story, we yield in many ways to the story. It's part. We want the story that we read to read us as much as we want to read it. We want the story to explain us to ourselves, to hold a mirror up to us to see who we are. But Dante is literally also implying the need to violate the letter of the Aeneid. He had to do because whatever Virgil had described exceeded believability. It was just an incredible account, and he wants to test the reality of that scene. So that's really the part of the confrontation between the two. And now let's see what he hears. "And the trunk said, thou who allurest me with thy gentle speech," is what we call captatio. I won't have to write it here on the board. The captatio benevolentia. You know, whenever a great rhetorical trick, whenever you give a speech, or whenever people speak to you in public especially, or privately, they will engage in this a way of capturing your benevolence by telling a story, playing with something about their modesty or whatever. Now, you so allurest me, so fascinate, so the lure of your rhetorical language, of your rhetorical powers. We are dealing with rhetoric, first of all with style, and now then with the language of the text, and now with the language of the exchange. So it is as if the suicide has a lot to do with this trait of language, this characteristic of language. Thou so allurest me with a gentle speech that I cannot be silent, and let it not burden you if I'm beguiled into talk for a little. I am he that held both the keys. Here is the pun on Peter. It's as if he were Saint Peter who holds the two keys of the kingdom, of Frederick's heart. And now you can see that all the language of believing, faith, that has been going around in the previous lines of the canto seem to be gravitating around the figure of Frederick, the king, who is a kind of, let's call him the god of the city, right? Because his name, that's what it means. In Italian especially, it's not in English, you say Frederick, it has a Federico, which really repeats the idea of faith within it, as if all faith, all beliefs really had to converge and go toward this emperor of Sicily. He's a Hohenstaufen, he's a famous a German king ruling over Sicily, and Pier della Vigna was the chancellor of the empire and also the founder, by the way. Let me say something more about him. He's the founder, he's the one who conceived the first university, the first state university in Europe, the University of Naples, because Frederick wanted a university that would prepare lawyers, diplomats, people who could go on state missions, who can write papers for the state, and that would not be at all one of the schools that where universities were under the aegis of, for instance, the canon lawyers, the theologians. So this was the first lay secular school in Europe. It was an imperial see, unlike, for instance, the University of Paris, which was under the simultaneous the dominion of both the Bishop of Paris and the King of France, and hence a lot of conflicts between the two. So he's a chancellor, he is the founder of the university, he was a poet, and he also compiled the so-called Institutes of Justice for the Kingdom, the institutes were all inspired by the language of moderation, the language of idealistic language of order, and the a natural law that could follow, could organize the state. And clearly, the reality is that by his act, Pier della Vigna shows that there's no such a thing, or that he doesn't really believe in what he claims to be the principle of the legal organization of the state, which is natural law. I held both the keys of Frederick's heart and turned them, locking and unlocking, so softly that I kept nearly every other man from his secrets. He is the secretary of the emperor. A word, as you know, secretary, which becomes very crucial throughout the Renaissance. He's a counselor. But the secretary means, it's a word that comes from the Latin, from to secrete. It is as if he's the figure who distills, that's secreting, distills that which the emperor keeps hidden in his heart. He has this power of distillation. And knowing also, and through this distillation, what has to be shared and what has to be kept concealed from all others. Okay, so quite a figure of prestige. He views himself as strict, and he was collaborator of the emperor. And I brought, again, such faithfulness. Now that question of fidelity in the way we read the text, in the way we believe what we read, is brought into, it's sort of refracted into the language of loyalty as faithfulness to the emperor, to the glorious office that I lost for its sleep and strength. The causes of the suicide, the causes of his tragic, of Pier della Vigna's tragic downfall are going to be the harlot, the personification for envy, the the sin. There is product that Aquinas, for instance, views as the worst possible sin, because it is really very close to hatred, and close to hatred in the sense that it has nothing. All sins have some positivity to it. You know, if you're a glutton, it's because that piece of cake, there's something about it that, you know, lures you to it. You're proud, it's because you really have some sense of your excellence, or some, which is a real sin, contempt for others, the belief that others are not as good as you think you are. So it's not so much that you look at yourself as stretching the hand toward the divinity, the pride of Lucifer, right? The real sin is that you kick around those who you perceive are below you. All sins have some kind of positivity, except for one, and that's envy. Because envy only likes nothing. It's not jealousy. You know, you do have that kind of story. So all of you, I'm sure, are readers of Othello, right? Because that's really a confrontation between envy and jealousy. There is the envy, Othello may be jealous, but the one who is really envious is Iago. He doesn't want Desdemona for himself. He can't stand the idea that the other guy is happy. That's envy. Jealousy is the fear of losing. Jealousy is almost an ingredient of love, Andreas Capellano says. If you really are in love, there must be some rational aspect to of jealousy in it. But here, the cause of the court, which is always the little microcosm, right? Even for Dante, who writes a treatise on language, or the theorists of love about the function of language in the court, because the court is the place of laws, is the place of poetry, is the place of political persuasion. You know? These are the various dimensions of the powers of language. And then you do know about the court from Andreas Capellanos. That's another topic for you to explore. Dante's figuration of the court, you know, from all possible points of view. Here, Dante views now the court as microcosm of political order and idealism as being literally poisoned by the presence of, contaminated by the presence of envy, the harlot, and that never turned her shameless eyes. And you understand that metaphor. It's not so much that it belongs to the harlot. The fact is that the word envy, as you know, is a word that in Italian or in English, invidious, it's invidia, which is etymologized as non video. So it's always an idea, it's a kind of blindness to the world outside. And here Dante's punning with this, turn the shameless eyes, which seem to be a sort of representation of the harlot, and the seduction of the harlot, but it's also plays on this notion of what envy really means. And common bane and the vice of courts, and now inflamed all minds against me. Look how the language now sort of takes over. It takes over, and Dante is just playing with and multiplying these terms, the same terms repeated over and over again. And those inflamed, so inflamed Augustus, the name for the emperor, or Caesar, that happy honors turn to dismal wars. This is the formula for the formulaic definition of tragedy that he's giving. Happy honors turn to dismal wars. Pierre de Levigne is aware of his own tragic destiny, his own tragic downfall, and seals his fate as a tragic fate. And now my mind, in scornful temper, thinking by dying to escape from scorn, made me just unjust to myself. And once again, the style of repetitions, anaphoric, Pierre de Levigne constitutes himself into a closed circuit, and the doubling of language reflects the self-doubling. And let me just go on and tell you what I think is going on here. When you read this sentence, and dying to escape from sorrow, made me just unjust to myself. And the obvious question that I think you should really ask, and if I gave you a chance to ask, you would ask, how many selves are there in him? Made me just unjust to myself. How many persons are there? How many figures are there in one, in Pierre de Levigne? The text that best glosses this scene, this tragic occurrence here, appears in the City of God of St. Augustine, book one, where Augustine is telling the story of Rome and the death of, and the end of the period of the monarchy, you know, the seven kings, right? The story was, and with the story of the seven, the expulsion of the Tarquins, the last king, is attributed to the fact that the famous matron of Rome by the name of Lucretia, whom Dante, by the way, mentions in Limbo, though, he has a lot of ideas about who or what is the guilt of a suicide. We shall see that a great figure from Roman antiquity, Cato, a suicide, will appear and will inaugurate the purgatorial canticle in Canto 1. So that is always making some crucial discriminations, crucial distinctions. At any rate, they are the story that that Augustine tells in book one of the City of God is that of the rape of Lucretia. The rape of Lucretia, and Augustine is fierce about the fact that she commits suicide. How does she then? She commits suicide out of the guilt and shame that she had been violated in rape by by Brutus. And she says, how does she dare to take her own life? Because here is the chaste Lucretia who is embarrassed of the unchaste Lucretia. This is a sin of false transcendence. The belief that I can be not completely, I do not coincide fully with who I am, so that I have to double myself, have to see myself as different from what I am. I can do justice against myself. By doing this for Dante, I'll go into Dante's text, this doubling of Pierre de Levigne is a sin of false transcendence. The way the suicide is playing God to oneself and is punishing oneself for wrongs that he, the suicide, perceives. Lucretia, she, that perceives as fouling her reality. You see what I mean? This is the kind of a kind of doubleness that seems to be running through, and Dante is rendering through this idea of style. By the new roads of this tree, I swear to you, never did I break faith with my Lord, who was so worthy of honor. And if either of you return to the world, let him establish my memory, which still lies under the blow that envy gave it. So the story of Pierre de Levigne exemplifies the story of, or dramatizes the story of the tragic experience of suicide. And Dante here gives of suicide an exactly theological and Augustinian account. He views it, looks at it from an Augustinian point of view. We skip Canto 14 and we go now to another memorable canto, a memorable Canto 15, a memorable encounter with Dante's teacher, Brunetto Latini, who was probably 50 years his senior, who was a translator who adapted in the vernacular Cicero's rhetorical works, who was a teacher of the Florentines, a teacher of Dante, and who really stands for the great values of the rhetorical, humanistic, or Ciceronian tradition. The idea of, he upholds the idea of the Republic of Florence. He's a wealth because he does not want, you do know that the Ghibellines are those who are in favor of the imperial control of the state, and for him to be a wealth is really to claim that he's on the side of the Republic, that he wants the Florentine Republic. He was sent on an embassy. He went to Toledo, by the way, which at the time was a center of great translations, and he may have brought from Toledo translations of that Dante knew, such as perhaps the account of the Muhammad's vision and the ascent to paradise. That's really a very doubtful question, but it circulates increasingly within Dante's studies, the perimeter of Dante's studies. And Brunetto, while he was going on an embassy to France, was banned from Florence. He eventually returned to Florence, but he's a figure that Dante really tries to pattern himself after. Effectively, the teaching of Brunetto is what guides him, at least in the initial phase of his political concerns. There are other experiences, intellectual experiences, that will intervene and will change radically Dante's thinking. What I'm trying to do in these classes is also to give you a sense of the shifts in his perceptions and his understanding of the world. I will be telling you at some point that there were extraordinary encounters that he had with some theologians and some philosophers within Florence that gave him a completely different view from the one that Brunetto Latini instilled in him. So let's see what happens between the two of them. We are in the area, once again, violence, this time violence against nature, and Brunetto Latini is condemned for a sin of sodomy. There is no evidence at all from any other sources that's where he was. And I have to tell you that Dante also has a different understanding of sodomy when he comes to purgatory. For instance, Canto 26, where the sodomites are in the process of redeeming, of seeking some kind of redemption and cleansing. But anyway, this is the canto here. Let's see how he proceeds. Now, one of the hard margins bears us on, and the vapor from the stream makes a shade above that shelters the water and the banks from the fire. The focus of the canto is once again the natural world, a natural world which is one of sheer chaos, and the natural world which is one of violence. And look at this image, as the Flemings between Vincent and Bruges, you know, the Netherlands, is describing literally the Netherlands, called such because they are lower, the surface of the land is lower than that of the water, and they have to protect the land from the violence of the water and the floods. So they build these dikes around. As the Flemings between Vincent and Bruges, fearing the flood rushing in on them, make the bulwark to drive back the sea, and as the Paduans do along the Brenta to protect their towns and castles before the Celentana feels the heat, these were made of the same fashion, except that the builder, whoever he was, made them neither so high nor so broad. So the natural world that can hardly be contained. That's the idea. The natural world that is always going to overwhelm all efforts to, all barriers trying to impede its violence. By the way, this is an image for those of you who are readers of literature even beyond the Middle Ages. It's a famous image that Machiavelli will use in chapter 25. Of the prince. Remember when he talks about virtue and fortune, and that the virtue of human beings, virtue, the word character, arete, no? The virtue of human beings is to build, you know, shelters whenever we expect the flood, but in the full knowledge that we are never really going to succeed, and yet we need these shelters just in case we might succeed. Virtue is always a little bit less powerful than fortune in his in that world. It's an image that one of the history plays, Shakespeare also uses. I'm not saying that he takes it from Dante, so we don't know whether he actually read Dante or not. Already, so this is the background of this encounter. Already, we had gotten so far from the wood that I should not have seen where it was if I had turned backward, when we met a troop of souls who were coming alongside the bank, and each looked at us as men look at one another under a new moon at dusk. Seems to create this kind of strange world of the night world, and they puckered their brows on us like an old tailor on the eye of his needle. What an extraordinary image. Dante will use something like this, not quite the same image, the tailor, when he's arriving, when he has to describe his own vision of paradise. It is as if the humblest experience in the city, in Florence, you know, the artisan, the tailor can only help him. The only thing he can think about as he's approaching the most sublime of experiences. That's Paradiso 33. And here, this most extraordinary story has also the ring of familiarity, though. That's really the image of the way I think this image works. The sense of a familiarity and with a familiar image of the tailor. And the tailor also a figure that takes your measure. The tailor is a figure of the artisan who, in order to fit you properly, has really to have your measure, your idea of who you are. Now, I thus, by that company, I was recognized by one who took me by the hand and cried, "How marvelous!" And I, when he reached out his arm to me, fixed my eye on his baked looks, so that the scorched features did not keep my mind from recognizing him, and bending my face to his, I answered, "Are you here?" said Brunetto. "Are you here?" said Brunetto. So this is a scene of the recognition. In Inferno, that's what you have, scenes of recognition, more than first encounters. It is as if, literally, recognizing means knowing people that you thought you knew anew, knowing them anew. All the figures that you thought you had knew something about, recognition. It means also giving a kind of understanding, giving a kind of the due to them, recognizing in that sense too. And he, "Oh my son, let it not displease thee if Brunetto Latini turn back with thee a little and let the train go on." Twice Brunetto will refer to Dante as, "Oh my son." This sort of acknowledging this filiation, acknowledging a kind of familiarity that goes beyond even any form of discipleship. And Dante will resist that solicitation, that affectionate solicitation, that familiarity. He will always refer to him as the image of a father, but twice. And then he says, "And I said to him, with all my heart I beg of you, and if you wish me to sit with you, I will, if it please him here, with whom I go," meaning Virgil, I mentioned as if Dante now were concealing, pro forma to be sure, the shifted loyalty from one teacher to another, and we're concealing it from Brunetto Latini. Again and once again, Brunetto, "Oh son, whoever this flock stops, etc., go on therefore, I shall come at thy skirt," which some critics have seen as the sign that this is that really Dante may have known something about Brunetto Latini that nobody else knew, and later rejoined my band who go mourning their eternal loss. Look at the spatial configuration of the scene. I think it's very significant. The disciple is above, the teacher is below, so that the disciple has to bow in order to be able to speak to the teacher, which would be a sign of his reverence for the authority of the master, but at the same time, it indicates that the hierarchy between them, this both, the hierarchy between them really has completely altered from the days that they were on in the city, in the streets of Florence. And then he tells the story. "Up above there in the bright light," I answered him. No, I'm sorry. "Does not descend from the track," etc. And he says, "What chance of destiny," Brunetto says, "brings thee down here before thy last day? And who is this that shows the way?" Chance? Destiny? Brunetto has no understanding of the trajectory of Dante's life and adventure. And this is really the beginning of a series of misunderstandings between the teacher and the disciple. Two different value systems are being deployed, and they are going to be in collision with each other. Brunetto speaks like a true humanist, a man who belongs to the Ciceronian and who espouses the Ciceronian ethics, for whom here the world is one indeed of chance encounters, destiny that takes us one way or the other, and there is nothing indeed providential about it. And Dante responds by really giving a kind of pithy summary of his experience in the last few hours. Up above there, in the bright light, I answered him, before my age was at the full, he repeats, Inferno 1. I lost my way in a valley. He appeared to me when I was returning to it, and by this road, he leads me home. These are extraordinary words, because what home means for the politically minded, Florence-centered sense of existence of Brunetto is not the idea of what home means for Dante. For Dante, home is the place of the soul, and the place where the soul is at its most distended, the distension of the soul occurs. For Brunetto, home can only be the city of Florence. One has a political frame of reference, the other one has a theological frame of reference, and the two are colliding with each other. Let's continue and see how this is extraordinary. He said to me, if you follow thy star, now again, an extension of the language, the metaphor picks up the metaphor of chance or destiny, kind of astrology, follow your star, right? The astrology of the destiny of Dante, thou cannot fail of a glorious heaven. Another, Dante is dramatizing the radical ambiguity of words that seem to be so bland, like glorious. What glorious means to a humanist is not what glorious means to a theologically minded thinker. You know, in theology, one thinks of nature, grace, and glory. Dante begins Paradise 1, the first word with which he begins is the glory of him, la gloria, him who moves all things. And glory for Brunetto means the happy ending, fame, and whatever. The glorious heaven, if I discerned rightly in thy fair life, and had I not died too soon, seeing heaven so gracious to thee, again, this is now glorious in grace once again to thee, I would have strengthened thee in thy work. But that thankless and malignant folk, which came down of old from Fiesole and still keeps something of the mountain and the rock, shall become for thy well-doing thine enemy. And with reason, for among the bitter sorbs, it's not natural the sweet fig should come to fruit. Old fame, so from Brunetto's point of view, the reference of all the crisis, the spiritual crisis, the loss of self of Dante can only be political. That Brunetto makes an incredible mistake of believing that Dante's experience is exactly the replica of his own. He lost the city while he was, by the way, at Roncesvalles, the place, you know, where the great paladin of Charlemagne or Roland it's a symbolic place he chooses, was defeated. And now this is exactly what he thinks is happening also to Dante, to the pilgrim, among the bitter sorbs, etc. Old fame in the world calls them blind. People are avaricious, envious, and proud. This is the three sparks that have set the hearts of the Florentines on fire. And there's pride, envy, and pride. Their fortune holds thee for such honor that one party and the other shall be ravenous against thee. So then the language, the prophecy of Dante's exile, the two parties, Guelphs and Ghibellines, will turn against him, etc. And Dante answers, were all my prayers fulfilled? I answered him, you had not yet been banished from humanity, for in my memory is fixed, and now goes to my heart, the dear and kind paternal image of you, when many a time in the world you taught me how man makes himself immortal, and how much I am grateful for it, my tongue where I live must needs declare. That which you tell of my course, I write and keep with another text for comment by a lady who will know if I reach her. clearly an allusion to Beatrice, though it will not be Beatrice who will make the prophecy of Dante's exile, but in the symmetrically connected canto 15-16 of Paradise will be Dante's own real grandfather. So the distinction between this fictional figure of a self-claimed spiritual father, Brunetto, and the heroic grandfather, Cacciaguida, the antithesis is very, very clear. And in the acknowledgement that Dante gives of Brunetto's teaching, when he says, "For in my memory is fixed and now goes to my heart, the dear and kind paternal image of you, where many time in the world you taught me how man makes himself immortal," there is also a little bit of a critique, a little bit of a distance that Dante establishes between himself and Brunetto. For the true point, the real, authentic point of Dante's experience is that man does not make himself immortal. Of course, we're involved through our works. Maybe there are many other forms of achieving some degree of immortality. One can make children to become immortal, one, you know, hope at least a provisional immortality, a continuity. But from Dante's point of view, the immortality that he's seeking is not man-made. It can only be a question of the salvation of his soul. So, in the very great acknowledgement, the form in which the disciple who just loves making these claims of indebtedness to the teacher, there's also a sense of a difference between them and misunderstandings. And this will be, in fact, the trait of this encounter to a teacher who has been shaping the disciple, and the disciple who has been going his own way, who somehow thinks that education means also is tantamount to an experience of freedom. It's what we, this is the way we began when I spoke about the figures of doubleness in Canto 12. And this is the theme that seems to be going through even in the encounter with Brunetto. And let's see now exactly then what is Brunetto's sodomy, or a way of understanding Brunetto's sodomy. Clearly linked to violence. We're in the world of violence. And so Dante wants to know about who the other sinners are. And Brunetto will comply and says they're all clerks and great and famous scholars. And he mentions them all who defile the world, one and the same sin. Priscian, a famous grammarian, Francesco da Corso, who also is, by the way, I think he's a lawyer, and if thou hast a craving for such scurf, etc. Now then he says, "I will say more, but I cannot go farther talking with thee. For I see there a new cloud rising from the sand. People are coming with whom I must not be. Let my treasure, in which I yet live, be commended to thee, and I ask no more." A true teacher, I say, who gives bibliography at the end. Says, "Okay, now you go and read my book. Not just read anybody's book, but I recommend to you my treasure, come in which I yet live, to be commended to thee." Then he turned about and seemed like one of those who run for the green cloth in the field at Verona, a ludic image, an image of a race, which is run in Verona, and he seemed not the loser among them, but the winner. So he leaves with the illusion that he is a precursor, as it were. You understand what I mean? That he's in a race, he's so far behind everybody else that he seems not to be ahead of them. He's really behind one circle. That's the image with which Dante ends this encounter. Brunetto recommends this treasure, which was a French text that he wrote. It's an encyclopedia that he wrote in while in France, and he wrote it in French. So much that, and it's so important, this text. It's one of the most important encyclopedias in the vernacular. Encyclopedias being, I don't expect you to remember it, but I gave you a definition of the Divine Comedy as a poetic encyclopedia, in the sense that it tries to gather together the broken pieces of knowledge, of experience, and at the same time, unlike the technical encyclopedias, such as the Britannica, give you, dramatize the presence of someone with being educated through them, a process of education. Dante is the one who is in the middle of learning. So it's an encyclopedia with a path about how to learn, not the abstract one that Brunetto had written. But it's written in French, and it's and I stress this fact because elsewhere, in one of his philosophical reflections, Dante goes on saying that we are all bound by natural affection for our own language. And because on account of that, there are those who have put forth the interpretation that Brunetto is here for the violating the natural bonds of affection that we have, that human beings have to their own natural language, to their own mother language, let's call it that. It could be. But what I think this is it dramatizes an incredible self-delusion on the part of Brunetto. Here he is, dead. Here he is, circling around under the rain of fire, and he thinks he still lives in his own text. He mistakes, first of all, the symbolic life that he has within a text with reality. That's the first confusion. The language of images, the languages of seeming that is running, that pervades this canto, has to be understood in terms of this confusion on the part of Brunetto. But there is more. There is more to it. The mistake that Brunetto makes is to believe that Dante's own life is a replica of his own. Read my text, because whatever it is that you have to know is already available to you in my own book. That is to say, he effaces the difference between Dante and himself and Brunetto. He refuses to see that Dante's own life can have its own development and its own destination, a destination which he cannot understand at all. So that's the end of Canto 15. This sodomy then is also a confusion between the real and the imaginary, the way of drawing the real world into one of fictions and imaginations. There is one scene before I stop and give you a chance to ask a question now. We're going to Canto 16. It's the end, really. We are reaching the end of the intermediate area, the moral, the ground of violence, which to us, of course, I just presume that you may be surprised, because our culture seems to view violence really as the worst possible crime, right? And violence in all of its forms and its expressions, the several psychological, physical, political, and so on. For Dante, the worst crimes are the crimes of fraud, as you know. These are bad enough to be sure. But and Dante so is about to enter in Canto with Canto in Canto 17, and he will see a strange figure. They have to go over a huge ravine. There is no way that they can do this, but then miraculously, a strange figure, a monster. They are at the edge, they stand at the edge of the pit, and a figure appears. This is the figure of Geryon at the end of Canto 16. Let me read this image, the figure of Geryon. Dante will mount on Geryon, and Virgil will sit behind him, and the descent takes place into the area of fraud. So this is the sequence of happenings in the canto. And now let's see what Dante says. It's an experience of we could even call it wonder in hell. It's an experience of almost the sublime. An infernal sublime. A man, I'm reading from 16, the line 130, or around line 130 and following. A man should always close his lips as far as he can to the truth that has the face of a lie. That's fraud. It's a mixture of truth and deception, truth and lies. That's what literature seems to do too, though, no? Since without fault it brings him shame. But here I cannot be silent. And by the strains of this comedy, this text called comedy, right, and it's a story, a moment of an experience of dissent. Comedy also captures this rhetoric of dissent, of lowering oneself, not just an ascetic experience. I swear to thee, reader, another, the second addressed to the reader. And you may remember that we saw one in Canto 9, and I tried to explain it to you as the address to the reader as part of the strategy of authority on the part of Dante, in the measure in which I need readers, and I may have readers, then I'm constituted into an author. You understand that kind of strategic move? So I swear to the reader that I saw coming, swimming up through that gross and murky air, a figure amazing to the stoutest heart, even as he returns or goes down sometime to lose the anchor that is caught on a reef or something else hid in the sea, stretching upward and drawing in his feet. This is the story. This is the approach of Geryon. What I want to point out is a number of metaphors here. This is an aerial journey. Geryon is flapping his wings and going through the murky air. Dante describes it as if it were a journey by sea. The metaphor he uses is swimming. I saw come swimming up through the gross and murky air. And by the way, when Dante is to describe the story of a mythic sailor, mythic mariner, Ulysses, whom we are going to encounter hopefully next week, I think it's going to be next week, or next time, he describes this journey by sea of Ulysses as if it were a journey by air. And he does this because for Dante, it doesn't matter how you are traveling, if you fly or you go by water. It doesn't matter, because all journeys are journeys to the same destination. All journeys are really journeys to the absolute. Here, Geryon seems only to come to play a ministerial function. He's going to minister, to serve Dante and his guide. And at the same time, Dante says, here too there is some kind of plan. Here too there is some kind of something of the absolute that I have to see. So that's the first image. The second image is this idea of which will be described really later, the rotatory movement of Geryon through the air. And I have been describing the circle, the spiral, the movement in a spiral, the spiral motion of all movement in Inferno. And the third, this is this idea of the swearing by Dante's own text. The text is given now the value of a sacred object, something that has something one can swear by. If we began with a violation of the Aeneid in Canto 13, now in Canto 16, Dante opposes to the Aeneid and replaces, therefore, the new text for us is this comedy. Let me stop here and let me see that we have a few minutes for questions, which I will welcome and try to answer about 5 to 10 minutes. Yes. Yeah. It's what we call a typological use of the emperor has to be, it's Augustus or Caesar. These are the two terms used for the emperor. So it's a type. It's the kind of abstract type, or the Tsar or the Kaiser. They're all versions of the Caesar myth. You know, I mean, in modern languages. So that's it. Yeah, Augustus. Yes. They're guilty of?
Guilty of lust. That they chose pleasure over rationality, and they're in the second circle. The Sodomites are in the seventh circle, and is the difference there because of the more serious violation of the natural law, or is this really an intellectual choice on their part to engage in both intellectual and physical, which is much more serious than the incontinence of the of people in the second circle?
The question is meant to have me think about the relationship between the sinners of lust and the sinners of sodomy. And the premise of the question is that in the sinners of lust, we have sinners who invert the order of reason and pleasure, whereas in the sin of the question then is, why are the sinners of sodomy placed in a further down in hell? And if this is because there's a question of an intellectual choice, this has been a, and my answer is the following, that the, no, there's no indication in this canto, in canto 15, that the sin here, that there is some, that intellectual perversions, because you are right, your question is well taken, that all clerics, in the sense of clerics, meaning not just what we today think as men of the cloth, but meaning intellectuals, Priscian, Accursius, who is also mentioned, their famous glossator of the laws, then Brunetto Latini himself. The sin here is a sin of violence. Just as we had the idea that education, the educators in Canto 12, are those who are who could pervert the very process of teaching. And just as in Canto 13, we had a Stoic, Pierre de Levigne is really a Stoic who now reflects that suicide is not a virtue and a virtuous choice. But these are sinners who have yielded to, whether it is anger, to this, the, and they have yielded to the impulses of violence within them. Dante, I think, is condemning sodomy, because I think this is also part of the question you're asking. May not be the central part, but because there is whatever, there has been violence connected to their activity. This is the, why would he place them in the circle of violence? Unlike, for instance, what happens to Guido Guinizelli in Canto 26, or Caesar, by the way, there is also an allusion to Caesar in Canto 26 of Purgatorio. So there is a difference there. A teacher who uses violence, so that's the link between teaching and violence in Canto 12. The man of reason, the Stoic believer in the logos and the order of rationality, exasperates that principle and believes that he can be both judge and victim, executioner and the executed one. And now in Canto 15 is this idea of the way in which violence has taken over and obfuscated the order of rationality. I don't see the element of choice in that. Yes.
Can you maybe discuss how Dante differentiates various representations of suicides? Since Lucretia's in limbo, Dido and Cleopatra are in the circle of the lustful, and then we have Pierre della Vigne, who is in the actual circle of suicide. And how is it that he makes the distinction between where they fall?
Excellent. The question is it possible to differentiate within different forms of suicide, since Dante, and that's exactly right, exactly true, Dante, we have Lucretia in limbo, we have Dido in Canto, two among the lustful souls, we have Cato in Purgatory, etc. And why here in Canto 13 the suicides are punished? Is there some kind of rationale that we can see behind the various, that's the question, the various forms of suicide? The answer that I would give is the following. Dante knows so well that there are that the phenomenology of acts, of various acts, is vast and cannot quite be ever be brought to one common element, so much that at the beginning of Canto 14, if you turn to Canto 14, Dante is going through the hot sands, because it's the burning sands of hell, and he recalls there, This must be exactly the burning sands of the Libyan desert that Cato crossed, which is a way of saying, you know, don't be surprised, I think, if you're going to encounter Cato a little further down. I know that you expect him to be here. So the question then is, how does Dante go on determining the value of a particular act? When we sin, this may be a little bit, I have to be very clear about this. When we sin, we usually can say, well, how can it be? I'm going to give you I'm going to take a little bit of distance from this whole question. It's easy to say, how can Dante be so ruthless that someone, for all we know, may have been a good human being, and then they committed one crime, and they are in hell forever, for eternity. And that, on the face of it, would seem to be a reasonable query, you know, a sort of indirect, oblique way of asking for a little bit more tolerance and benevolence from this man who claims to be the supreme judge of all human beings have been perpetrating. The fact is that whenever we sin, all sins are involved. We think that it's only one, but all sins are involved. And Dante highlights one specific aspect. In the case of Dido, her lust is more important and, in the sense, more decisive and determines the character of that figure than the suicide. The suicide is seen as an extension of her lust. In the case of Lucretia, put in limbo, there is a way in which Dante really wants to make that clear distinction, and even it's an anti-Augustinian Augustinian moment, that Lucretia's virtues seem to have been limited as they are. She's not saved in any way, but there is a kind of exemplary virtue that allows him to sort of remember but not punish her for a crime, which is really to be understood as a consequence of an excessive way of understanding virtue. You see what I'm saying? In the case of Cato, and we are going to see that, he sees the sacrifice of self for freedom. That's really the great understanding. Cato dies for the sake of freedom. And all the canto of Purgatory is the canto one of Purgatory is a reflection on the question of freedom. Roman freedom, and by the way, the biblical Jewish understanding of freedom. You know, I'm preparing you for that canto, so maybe I'll save myself the trouble of repeating these things when we get there. Dante will talk about Roman freedom through Cato, and immediately after, a troop of angels will arrive, and they sing one song, which is In Exitu, Israel, the Egypto, which is to say the Jewish, this famous Psalm 113, this Psalm of David, where David is reflecting about the epic of Exodus, a lyrical reflection about the idea that getting from Egypt on the way to Jerusalem was, which only some got to, for instance, Moses never did, is really a quest for freedom. So there are two ideas of freedom, a political, civil freedom, and the theological idea of freedom. And that's really the key to understanding the Cato and understanding the way Dante connects these two traditions, the Roman and the Jewish traditions. Other questions? We have 1 minute, and the tape probably lasts just about 45 seconds. So we'll get the question or answer. Questions?
Seems like you're saying here that Dante is almost finding a kind of sin when virtue is taken to an excess.
Yes.
And people like Lucretia and Cato,
he's
saying you can go too far, you can be too obsessed with a certain,
yes,
almost a misdirection of virtue.
Yes. The it's not a question, because I said yes, and I would agree. The reflection is, it seems, I don't like that, it seems that I'm saying, but I'm saying that actually, that in Dante views the excess of virtue also as part of it, something, part of the sin, a sin. And I would agree. I would agree, yes. Okay, thank you. We'll see you next time.